6 o'clock and we're rolling.
Proverbs.
Man, you got a lot of
today. Last day before break.
All right, gang, let's do this.
Proverbs.
Proverbs 32 again.
11.
Oh. Ooh.
This one goes to 11.
What a weird.
We're less than a teen today.
Hello.
This is I don't know how to take this.
Mike, by the way, just real quick, we weren't supposed to collect your package yesterday.
It's funny that we had Schaefer preaching yesterday.
11:31. Let's start with the last verse of Proverbs 11. Julian.
Yes, sir.
All yours, buddy.
I was waiting for the...
You're waiting for the columnist to...
I'm waiting for the chair scoots. Yeah.
Wait, hold up. Keep that.
Hold up.
11:31. Mm-hmm. All right, go ahead.
Wait. No, our chair's not doing that. Never mind. If the righteous is repaid on earth, how much more the wicked and the sinner?
All right, the righteous will be rewarded on the earth, how much more the wicked and the sinner? This is just a... conceptually, the idea of there's going to be payment for debts paid or debts owed, if you will, in the sense that, man, if you're righteous, you're going to be rewarded in the earth. When you invest in a life that is worthwhile and honorable, you're going to get the just rewards of that. You're sowing something. And also, how much more the wicked and the sinner? That if you are living a lifestyle that is not of God, not righteous, you're going to pay the due consequences of that, both on the earth and long term. The concept that I want just maybe to bring to our attention is the idea of the laws of the harvest, in terms of we are all sowing something. Okay, we are either sowing seed that we will reap one day that will be positive and beneficial and godly and in the minds of Him, or we are sowing seeds that are going to be of destruction or what have you. And whether we realize it, whether we're intentional or not, we are all sowing something. So along those lines, with the idea of the righteous being rewarded, the wicked being recompensed for their deeds, just a couple thoughts on the harvest. So just write these down if you want to take note, but in different seasons, maybe we're thinking about it differently, and just something to process for all of us, okay? Number one, I would just say this, we're all sowing something, okay? We are all putting our life's effort towards something. We're either chasing vanity, Solomon talks about, we're trying to grasp the wind in our hand or water in our hand, we're chasing after things that ultimately are gonna burn, money, power, prestige, sex, happiness, whatever category of thing that we think we're going to ultimately bring us satisfaction. Some of us are chasing those things, hopefully not those in this room, or we're sowing something that has eternal value. The Word of God and the souls of men, it's been said, are the only two things that are going to last forever, in the sense that on this earth, those are the only investments that we're going to make deposits in that are eternal, that makes sense. So people's lives in the Word of God. And the more time we spend investing in those, the more eternal those rewards will be. So you're sowing something. Secondly, you reap what you sow. If you put apple seeds in the ground, you can expect to have an apple tree, hopefully one day. But you're sure not going to have an orange tree. This much we know, right? You reap what you sow. So if you're putting things in an eternal bank account, you can expect to reap those one day. And likewise, if you're doing the opposite, you're going to reap what you sow. Okay? Thirdly, you reap in a different season than you sow. This is good to remember. We don't always know what those seasons are, and we don't always know when we are putting deposits into an account when we're going to see the benefit of those. You guys are in a season, at least with residency, that you're sowing. You're not reaping. You're putting in deposits. You're paying a price. You're making sacrifices. You're getting here early. You're rearranging schedules. You're having to find childcare for your kids at 5 a.m. so you guys can be here. You guys are making different levels of sacrifice in order to make this 9-month journey important, right? And you're probably not seeing great immediate rewards, right? What you're feeling is, I'm tired, it's early, I don't want to get up, things like that. But these will pay off later. You're going to feel and experience one day, hopefully, if we don't all suck, the benefits of this program, right? It's going to be hopefully beneficial to you guys. So remember that. How long between reaping and sowing? We don't know. You know, in ag, we do know in most things. There's plants that you can sow in early on that you won't see a harvest for sometimes 3 years down the road, okay? And in life, it could be even longer. So remember that. You're going to reap in a different season than you sow. Fourthly, you reap more than you sow. What you put in will come out in spades later on. The harvest tells us that. Ag tells us that. Remember that, okay? The work that you put in will grow exponentially when you get to reap it later. So sow with faith, sow with the idea that you know there's going to be a blessing at the end. And then lastly, I would say this. The results ultimately of what you sow are not up to you. They are up to the Lord, okay? So as you guys are being faithful and investing in things that are eternal, remember that God's direction is going to guide that, not necessarily you, okay? So for those of you that are just thinking through that, and sometimes we don't take the time to pause and just to think, Lord, I'm making investments in things that matter, rejoice in that. And you may not be celebrated for that now. You may not be seeing the fruits of your labor now, but one day you will, and you'll look back on seasons like this and be grateful that you paused and made investments in lives and things that matter, okay? So if you think through the laws of the harvest, just keep that in the back of your brain. All right?
The results of what you sow, what is it?
Up to the Lord, not up to you. Okay? Speaking of sowing and reaping, sow your alarm clock to go off 10 minutes early so that I don't reap unhappiness when you guys walk in late. Guys, we start at 6, okay? Butts and seeds, coffee ready, 6 o'clock every morning. This is when it starts to get lax, okay? And it's just now November. Wait till it gets really cold. We actually are in winter, okay? So do me a favor, work on that, okay? Be here on time, be respectful to your peers, and let's make sure that we're making an effort to be here and ready to go and ready to learn at 6, okay? Fair enough? Okay. Let's go to Exodus, shall we? Hannah, will you pray for us this morning, please?
Yeah.
And we will dive into Exodus.
Heavenly Father, thank you for another day of life and for getting us all up and here safely. I just ask that you would speak to us through your word, no matter what we're going through, God, that we would have an open heart and an open ears to listen what you have for us, and that you would give us hearts that are willing to follow through with that and to obey, and just a greater desire to serve you. Thank you for what you did on the cross, and for loving us as we are. We love you, and in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
All right, so we are about to enter into and have a little bit already this bizarre kind of section of scripture that at times was very foreign to us as Christians, talking about the Mosaic Law and these laws that God had given to his people. We're going to get into some very practical applications of those laws in terms of why God gave them to Israel. And then we're going to spend a third of the book of Exodus, if you can believe it, walking through the blueprints of a structure that God's going to have the nation create. And I'll walk you guys through that visually so you can see some of this. Alex, you're supposed to be at residency right now. That's what your computer says. By the way, Alex saved my bacon this morning. I spent about an hour redoing all of my slides and left my computer at home. Thank you, Dropbox. So, thank you, Alex. So we're going to walk through that. We'll see it. Okay, so we picked off, or left off, I should say, chapter 20 yesterday, walking through the Ten Commandments. Okay, the first maybe three or four are Godward. The first, or the last six really, are our relationship with fellow humans, if you want to look at them that way. And again, these are the cliff notes of the entire 613 laws. So as you think about why God put these on display for us to see at the beginning, this is kind of the preamble of any agreement. This is kind of how you would do it. Okay, so you're giving the maybe in my world the executive summary of a business plan. So instead of handing you guys a 26-page paper, which I wrote to launch off the front, I hand you a 1-page executive summary saying this is what we're going to do. And if you want good material to put you to sleep, here are the other 26 pages, right? So that's the idea. So all of the laws are basically going to fit into these 10, in a sense. And as Thomas mentioned yesterday, they really fit into two. Love God and love people. That's what Jesus was asked. What is the greatest commandment? And he said, man, love God, love others. Like, it's that simple. And those are his two summary statements of the law. Deuteronomy 6, the Shema, and Leviticus 19, I think. Anyway, so it's there somewhere. I think that's right. Yeah. So where did we leave off? In the midst of 20, we were talking about, remember the Sabbath we got there? Okay. So that is in verse 8, the idea of keeping the Sabbath day. Again, 6 days of work, and we're called to rest. Okay. How about verse 12 now? Let's pick up on the fifth of the Ten Commandments, and let's read this one.
Honor your father and your mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you.
Isn't that fascinating? Honor your mom and dad. What does it mean to honor your parents in this context? To obey them, to respect them. Turn real quick to one page over. Chapter, one page if it's in your Bible, if you have reading the same Bible I have. Bottom left-hand corner. Chapter 21, verse 17. How about this? Derek, read that.
21:17.
Yes, sir.
Anyone who curses their father or mother is to be put to death.
Snap.
What? Can you imagine? Now, we have no record of this ever happening in Israel in terms of a child being put to death for dishonoring their parents. How serious is God about honoring your parents? What if they tell you to go to bed at 8 and you don't want to go to bed at 8? It don't matter, right? You honor your parents. What if they make a rule for you for curfew? What if they say you can't hang out with that scumbag guy? Or you can't, whatever it may be, or this is the guy you're marrying, or whatever. To curse your parents was seen as such an atrocity in Israel, such a breaking of the family system, that God says you can literally put someone to death over it. So,
what about verse 15? It says anyone who attacks their father or mother would put to death.
Yeah, that apparently is bad too, so don't do that either. But you, I mean, that what you expect, right? Like, okay, you put a beat down on your parents and that's okay.
I mean,
but cursing them?
Isn't that crazy though? Like, where people are there, like, to do that?
We're going to get to some of these, but the idea is God is so protective of the family in Israel because it's the nucleus of all that's going to occur in terms of teaching, the priests, the bigger picture on the pastors and elders. Man, they're supplements. The sustenance, the main source of godly learning is the home and in the family. And if that gets out of whack, then God realizes, man, this whole system's going to break down. So honor your parents. One day you're going to be a parent. You get to make your own calls. You get to make your own decisions, good or bad or indifferent, right? But while you're underneath their headship, you honor them. Some of the hardest conversations we've had at the well have been in those issues where you see a young, godly man or woman that's moving towards marriage with another young, godly individual, and parents are not for it. And it locks up their hard drive. And sometimes it's godly parents saying, man, I see something that I don't like in this, so no, you do not have a blessing. We've had issues where we've had parents that were ungodly, and a godly person trying to marry somebody that was equally godly, and from a pastor's perspective, you go, man, game on, absolutely. That looks to be a very healthy, God-honoring union, and a parent saying, no, I'm not going to allow it to happen. Like, man, what do we do with that? You know, and having those conversations are fascinating to navigate.
I was going to ask you actually about that. Where do they draw the line with that? Because I ran into the same situation in the past before.
Yeah.
Into where it was just, if I don't have my parents' blessing, it's not going down.
Yeah.
And I was just like, well, yeah, what do they not like me for, though? Like,
yeah.
You know, I thought I'm doing everything by the book.
Yeah. It's situational. It all depends on the situation. There's not
like,
a...
You can honor them, but not honor their sin. Because if they have, you know.
No. Yeah. If it's sin, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's, man, they see stuff or are trying to make sure that the health of their son or daughter is the most primary concern. So sometimes they're not in favor of the situation. We have seen issues where it was just downright legalism and sin on the parent's side, where you said, hey, you're wrong, and with all due respect, love you mom and dad, but I've come underneath the authority of the church and this is healthy. We've worked it out. We tried to talk about it. You are clearly in sin. And in those situations, we would maybe counsel them differently, but those are the exception for sure, not the rule. So,
yeah,
but those are hard. Katie, did you have a thought?
Yeah. Because you said, like, until you're no longer under their headship, which I'm assuming means until you get married. Or
20 months. In this context, it would be because you lived in your parents' home, especially as a woman, until marriage. In our context, that may look a little bit different. But man, if If parents are paying your gas bill, your PG&E, if you're living in their home, if they're paying your insurance, if they're helping you out financially, you're still underneath their care. So that's not so much an age thing, but it's when are you independent of them, right? But I would say even in the context... Correct. Yeah. So when you come underneath the authority of your husband one day, then that's going to be the authority structure. So you listen to them and still honor them for sure, but you're, you'll be called to submit to that man. I mean, I'm not required to submit to my in-laws per se. Do I honor them? Absolutely. You know. So I think to speak of anybody, we see the Bible talk about honoring the aged and rising before them, the generation that would be older than us, to show them their due respect. So absolutely, in that sense, applies to everybody. So yeah, okay. So fascinating. I mean, this is a, how many problems do you guys see in today's society because of kids that don't honor their parents, right? And parents that don't correctly instruct their kids. You know, I work with those kids every day, and it takes 3 seconds to figure out which kids have solid parents that are being invested in and taught and learning how to listen and be respectful, and the kids that home's a disaster. It's very easy to figure that out, right? And anybody that's in education, you guys see this daily, right? And it doesn't take long to like completely jack that. You can see in a first or second grader pretty clearly the trajectory that they're on, and if there's not a massive turn in that, you can see where these kids are gonna occur. By the way, you know how they determine prison population rates? You know what their key factor is? Third grade literacy rates. If you can't read by third grade, the odds of you ending up in prison are like skyrocketing, different than the kid that can. Fascinating. So, can you all read? Yep. Can you imagine the difference that you could make in a classroom just tutoring kids? It isn't rocket science, and you could completely change your trajectory in life, right? Just by helping a kid learn a basic skill. It's one of the reasons off the front why we incentivize kids in the area of English, right? It's important. So, for what it's worth, okay? So, honor your parents, okay? Next, verse 13.
You shall not murder.
Good. Do we need to cover that one anymore? Frown upon in Israel, frown upon here, right? Don't murder, okay? Obviously. So this is our relationship now with other human beings, okay? Verse 14, number 7.
You shall not commit adultery.
All right. You're going to honor not just your parents, but you're going to honor other people's relationships. You're not going to covet another man's wife or another woman's husband. And you're not going to commit adultery. That, again, that family unit, essential. Okay, keep rolling, Derek.
You shall not steal.
Okay, number 8, so you're going to honor other people's property. What's theirs is theirs, what's yours is yours. Don't covet it, and don't steal it. Okay, verse 16.
You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor.
What does that mean?
Don't lie.
Yeah, don't lie. Don't throw people on the bus. Don't gossip. Right? If you don't know for sure, then don't say it. Don't spread what you're not sure is true or not. And if you're not sure, then go to them and talk about it.
So last night when I got off work, this lady was parked in my parking stall, and I had their car towed. And this morning I realized it was like my next door neighbor. Like, she was like super mad, banging on my door and stuff super early in the morning.
Let's play a game. Which 10 commandments did Derek break in that?
She's like super mad. She's like mad, mad. It's like, I gotta take my kids to work. Gotta.
Wait, so you actually did this? It wasn't a scenario.
I actually did
this. Oh my goodness.
It was in my park.
She was not honoring your
father. Oh, man.
Okay, it doesn't feel like it's
consistent. Yeah.
For a second, I started wishing people would do that where I work, because we have 50 parking stalls and 100 people working at that.
Between you and the Lord.
Yeah.
I don't see anything in the Ten Commandments that you violated. How about that? I would recommend a gift card and a knock on the door.
I didn't even know it was hers, though.
You know what? It'd go a long way to say, you know what? I'm sorry. My bad. And sorry about that. So... What was that towing bill? Any idea? $500?
No.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Derek.
Ryan, you know what?
Gift card, man.
$10 gift certificate to Starbucks.
And a hug.
And a hug and say you're sorry. So, tell you, I had no idea. And if you were like, if you were stupid rich, I'd pay the park, the towing bill. Yeah, I'm with you. I don't have an extra $500, so. But yeah, go mend the relationship. So. She's in the fetal position in her apartment crying. Is where she is. So. That's a tough one, man. That's relationship's important though. Go mend the relationship. So she blew it. You maybe could have handled it differently. You did it the way you did. You weren't wrong in doing that. But that's tough. Wonderful. All right. Very false witness. Last one of the 10, verse 17.
You should not covet your neighbor's house. You should not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor.
Right, so a lot of us could probably roll through here and say, okay, I haven't murdered, I haven't slept with anybody else's spouse, blah, 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 blah. The last one kind of is a catch-all for everybody. Have you ever desired something that isn't yours? Okay, yep. So, a whole lot of stuff. What is it? Doesn't matter, but you're in that category. So God's telling us, this is living a life of contentment, right? So they just learned about the God of the just enough in the wilderness. Don't envy somebody else's steak and eggs, man. You're getting manna. Just enjoy it and don't covet it. And there may be seasons where you're going to get blessings from God. God's going to bring them a buffet of quail one day. They can eat meat to their heart's content, right? And God's going to teach them a lesson about coveting things that they don't have, and it's going to be rough. So those are the Ten Commandments. So chapter 20 is the preamble to really this covenant that they're now going to be under. And then God is going to walk through in amazing detail all these other laws, okay? So if you think about chapter 20, that really is kind of the Cliff Notes version of what we're going to come to, okay? Now, we're going to kind of skip some rocks through some of these, but some of these laws, you're going to look at them and go, man, these are so insanely practical. If our society would follow these, we would be rid of probably 95% of the problems that we deal with in and out. It's insane, okay? Chapter 21, let's start there. Okay, this is one of my favorite images in the Old Testament, okay? Again, Old Testament is all written about with the idea of shadows, it's crayon, it's pictures, and God's trying to show us something. 21 is a really strong text. Okay, there's some stuff in here that's super hard, and there's some stuff in here that's really applicable. Yeah, Derek.
Oh, what is covet?
To desire something that isn't yours. To want for what you don't have. I really want a house in Carmel, and my friend has one, and I covet that. I want it. I spend time thinking about it and desiring it.
Like envy.
Very, very similar, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. So, all right. 21:1, let's pick up here.
These are the laws you are to set before them. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he is to serve you for 6 years. But in the seventh year, he shall go free.
All right, so 21:2 is talking about the idea of really an indentured servant, okay? If you have someone in your household that you're paying money to, they are technically your property, but after 6 years in Israel, it's ollie oxen free. Everybody gets to go home, okay? So if you have someone in your care after 6 years, you are to set them free, okay? They are to go as a free man without payment, okay? They can be free. If he comes alone, so if this said bondservant that you have, or the servant that you have, becomes an alone, he should go out alone. If he is the husband of a wife when he comes to you, then his wife shall go out with him, okay? So if he came into your home and had a wife before coming into your home, when you set him free in 7 years, he gets to leave with his wife, okay? However, if his master gives him, in verse 4, a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall belong to her master. He shall go out as alone. How about that? So I go work for Kyle, and I'm his indentured servant. And he gives me Michelle, and I have a wife now, and then I have 3 kids. And in 7 years, Kyle says, hey, it's been great. Mike, you're free to go. Can I take my wife with me? Nope. How about those 3 kids? Nope. They are now owners. Kyle owns them. They are part of his property. Now, he could set them free as well. This can be done for a woman as well, but this is kind of an odd text. One of those things like, man, how does that work?
I noticed it said this is for a Hebrew servant, or mm-hmm. is it different for non-Hebrews?
They're treated the same. Okay? In the same chapter, we're going to see that God does not allow you to discriminate against races, religion, or not even religions here, but mostly races, skin colors, and that sort of thing. He's going to remind them why here in a bit. Okay?
Why?
But that defeats the whole purpose of a covenant marriage, though. So does that mean he's divorced between her once he's set free?
No, it's just that there's a different stipulation for whatever reason as to why you did not get to keep that deal. So
he gets to visit her on Tuesdays. And then...
yeah, and this isn't necessarily the context of, I don't know how that would work, okay? Now, here's the deal. This is what's fascinating. So again, sometimes the imagery that we put with these words of slavery and servant in our context are very, very strong. Have you ever heard of a situation like this? Okay, Aaron, keep reading in 5.
But if the slave says plainly, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out as a free man.
What does that tell you about the nature of the slave-master relationship in Israel?
Fantastic.
It's what?
Fantastic.
Yeah. Do you know any slaves? They're like, no, like, I'm going to stay. I'm going to voluntarily stay because I love my master. I love this relationship. That is what this relationship was supposed to look like. Were you paid to do a job? Yes. Were you tied to that job? Yeah, you can't quit. But after 7 years, if you want to go free, you can actually say, you know what? This has actually been great. I've enjoyed it here. I am now going to choose to stay. Not because I have to, but because I want to. So that master could say, okay, great. Let's just keep rolling the way we're doing it. And we're going to pay you. And you're going to be here. But now you're not going to be under compulsion. You're going to be because of freedom. You choose to stay.
I feel like we see slaves in a different light than they're seen here. Were they really more of like contracted workers that willingly put themselves under, you know, to work for someone for 6 years and I'm going to come through on my word?
Yeah.
And it's simply a contract that they're saying, if you give me 6 years, you're going to give me 6 years?
Yeah. It really is very similar to like Jacob and Laban. That was the situation. Jacob was a slave to Laban. But the difference would be, yes, the healthy relationships there. At times, because of economics or whatever, that's all you had. So think in Egypt when they were selling themselves to Pharaoh, that was like, man, this is, I have no other collateral. The only collateral I have is my body and my skill set. I can lift heavy things or whatever. And so I'll do that. So absolutely, I think it's a much better picture of what it was supposed to be like.
I think also in the verse before that, we're saying, you know, if you have a wife and you get Michelle and you have kids, I think you being released of your duties, you now can't provide for your family. And so I think it's more of the responsibility of the master to be able to say, well, you have this family.
Yep.
Your family will still be taken care of.
Yep.
You want to find a job elsewhere, and then they complete their duty, then, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's a good note, and we're going to see more of that in the practicalities of how you can and can't handle marriage and a wife. So that's certainly mentioned in terms of the value that the master is required to take care of their servants at a certain level. Okay, so for what it's worth, I think the context is very different in terms of what we think of when we hear slaves. Okay, so now, fascinating picture here. Don't miss this. If this freed slave says, you know what? No, I'm going to stay. It's been a great relationship. He can choose to do that. Verse 6, here's the process by which he would commit himself to the house. Thomas, read that.
Verse?
Oh, wait, Derek wants to read it. Derek, he's feeling it. He's in the zone. All right. This better be golden, though. Golden pipes, Derek, right now.
Then his master must take him before the judges. He shall take him to the door or the doorstep and pierce his ear with an awl. Then he will be his servant for life.
Okay. My text says he takes him before God. Okay. You would literally go to the doorpost of your house, the same doorpost that you put for the Passover, and you would take your ear and put it in the doorpost, next to the doorpost, and your master would take an awl, an ice pick, and drive it through your ear. Woo! Okay? What in the world is going on here? How bad do you want to stay if you know, okay, this is the commitment I have to make, right? This is not just, hey, you're getting a pay raise. Oh, super, I'm going to stay. It's like, hey, this comes with a commitment. Why this picture? Why would this be the process that you would go through as a freed slave to say, this. What are you committing yourself to in this process?
Lifetime of pain and work.
Not necessarily. I mean, you're going to be working, yes. You're going to be doing whatever you're doing before.
Blood in, blood out.
Maybe. The idea is you're committing yourself to this house, to this home. You're a freed slave that's chosen to return to a good, apparently godly Hebrew master. And you're saying, I'm committing myself to this house And this is the imagery of it. So any slave that had a hole in his ear or the scars of a hole, you knew that's a bondservant. That's a different type of slave. That's not just a servant, a doulos in the Greek, but a bondslave is the concept. Okay, that's the picture.
Was it like a hole, like a piercing, or something like bigger?
It's not this little, you know, hole that I used to have in like eighth grade, right, that you can't see anymore. This would have been a much more significant scar.
So like gauges.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I don't know if that stayed or if it grew over, but there certainly would have been a little bit more scarring involved.
Okay, first of all, did you actually have your ear pierced in eighth grade?
Absolutely. I can still run it through. Every now and again, my kids are like, no, you didn't. And I've got to push it through and be like, see,
a little blood.
I'll throw one of Mama's earrings every now and again. Just for a moment, because I don't want earrings, you know. Rocking the hoop. Yeah, but I don't dress up in women's clothing like Kyle.
Is it the same, like, imagery and wording as when they talk about how our slaves to righteousness in Romans?
Wow. Let's turn to Romans and find out, Katie. What a great segue. Wow. Thank you.
Wow.
Turn to Romans 1.
What page is that on?
I'll let Katie explain it here in a second. Romans 1 is on page 1790. So just turn to that page.
Perfect.
Okay. Yeah. Romans 1:1. Katie, read that.
Paul, a bondservant of Christ.
Paul, a what?
Bondservant.
What is a bondservant? A freed slave that chooses to return to his master. Now, if you didn't know Exodus 21, you have any idea the context of what Paul's talking about here?
Nope.
I'm not a slave to Christ, to God, because I have to be. I am a slave to God and to Christ because I want to be. I'm choosing that. This is my master. I have chosen to follow him because who he is, his nature, and his character. So when Paul's using that language, Exodus 21 is what that's built on. I'm a freed slave, willingly serving my master because my master is good. Okay? That's the picture. How often does Paul describe himself as a bond servant of Christ? As you guys read through, just keep that image. That's often, right? And that's the picture. And that's, gang, this is the Old Testament. Can you still read that and go, oh, okay, bond servant, whatever. Yes, but all of a sudden SD goes to HD when you understand the context and the background and the imagery and the ideas that are communicated in the Old Testament now that show up in the New. Okay? That's why our Old Testament is so important. Yeah, Jim.
I know when I said blood and blood out, it was funny, but I meant it seriously about the ear. Like it's a sign that they're willing to go through that suffering for that servant, for that master, and that it's not something that you can take lightly. And that it's literally by this blood I'm showing you I'm willing to serve you, and by my blood I will stop serving.
That's good. Well, and obviously the issue of blood in the Old Testament is not taken lightly. So that's a good illustration. Okay. So come back to Exodus, but just wanted to show you guys that picture. It is meant to be significant. It's meant to require a sacrifice, but that is the picture of a bondservant in Israel. Okay. You know what? We're here. Let's just keep reading through this section. Okay. This is good on kind of slave-master relationships. Some of these verses are, again, in our context, they're hard. We don't quite understand them. Okay. So that's verse 6. Verse 7. Keep going.
If a man sells his daughter as a servant, she is not to go free as male servants do. If she does not please the master who has selected her for himself, he must let her be redeemed. He has no right to sell her to foreigners because he has broken faith with her.
All right, so we see this mentioned here in verse 7. If a man sells his daughter, like you're in dire straits, the only way that you can provide is to allow your daughter to be in this relationship as an indentured servant to pay for your household, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. Now, Deuteronomy actually talks about it a little bit differently, that both male and female, I think older women, are allowed to go free just like they are here in the beginning of Exodus 21. Are there guidelines as to how you're to treat your servant? Yes. If she's displeasing, if the master is unhappy with how she operates in the house or her workload or whatever it may be, she then has the ability to be redeemed. He can sell her to someone else. However, she's only to be sold to another Hebrew. You can't sell them to a foreigner. Why would that be the case? Yeah, because they're going to be treated, hopefully, in a godly way for all those Israelites, Hebrews, that are underneath the covenant of God. This is the expectation. So you don't get to sell her to a Midianite, to an Egyptian, to an Ishmaelite like Joseph was, because they're not people that honor and follow God. So they're not going to be treated with the dignity and respect that they would deserve.
So how did these people become slaves, though?
Literally, it would be the haves and the have-nots. So when you hit times in history where you economically couldn't make it, that would have been a process you would went through. Look, I sold my farm. I sold my car. I don't have anything else to sell, and I need to make food. Derek, can I come work for you? Yeah, and we're going to agree to 6 years, and you're going to say, yeah, Mike, you can come into my household, and you're going to till my land, and you're going to sow this, and you're going to pay me to do so, but you're going to treat me with respect the way that the Scripture says to. So it's really on hard times. But again, this is not based on skin color. This is not based on race. It's really based on, man, you're in dire straits, and you're going to treat me with the dignity of a fellow human being and a fellow Hebrew. And that's the idea, okay?
Can I just work down for?
What's that? Very similarly, yeah. So you've maybe got the means to pay me. I need a job, and that's just kind of where it's at. So these are, again, this is all Hebrew relationships. So this isn't outside of that realm. Yeah, Kyle.
Did it work out if a daughter is sold to where her freedom can be given if she is then given off as like a wife to another male slave?
Yeah, and we'll see that. I don't know that specific scenario exists, but she can leave the house after 7 years as well. I think when she's older, as a woman. Okay?
Can this concept also be looked at as giving a hand up in a way? Because I know that it's a lot easier for us to just give handouts.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that this is a way of providing the people who need, but still teaching them the value of you have to work for what you get.
Yep.
And this is a way of the people that have more are to give to those that don't have less.
Yep.
But to still teach them that work ethic.
I think that's a great way to look at it. I actually read a commentator, and at the time I was like, man, really? He said, in this culture, sometimes as a father, you were happier that your daughter was committed to this home where you knew that a master would take care of her and provide for her in a right way than if she was underneath your home where you could not. So it was actually better that she couldn't go free, that this master was committed to her and her well-being. Now listen, moving on, this is how he is the master in this situation, called to take care of her. If he designates for her in verse 9 a son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. If he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food, her clothing, or her, my text says, conjugal rights. The better translation for that would probably be food, clothing, and shelter. Was probably the idea. Conjugal rights, we all understand kind of the concept of that. So if you have multiple wives, sometimes these were concubines in this type of situation. But the idea is the basic necessities of life, food, clothing, and shelter, she has those. You will provide those rightly in a godly way. Okay. If he will not do these things for her, these three things for her, verse 11, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. She's free to leave. So if he does not, the master, provide for her in a godly way that God says to, she's free to walk.
Would this be the scenario, obviously it's after Genesis, but would this be the scenario that Sarah and Abraham kind of worked out? Like, hey, I've got this bond servant, she's Egyptian, kind of thing?
I think that's different. That's just Abraham being an idiot.
Who was the judge?
Mine says God in this, but they would have been the judges would have been the male leaders of households, like Moses is told to get. Those would have been the judges in the land. The men that were respected in their communities that were older. Okay? So odd text again, but here we go.
Can people use this verse to justify divorce? Like, if your husband doesn't take care of you, you get to leave?
No. It depends what you mean by care. Like, does he provide for me?
If he doesn't.
X amount of dollars in income.
No, but
and,
like, if you're not eating and you're not. Like, you're in a bad place because he's not providing.
I would say the three things that I see New Testament concept when you take the Old Testament and integrate it with the New. The three reasons that we see God allows for divorce are adultery, abuse, or abandonment. So if that fits into abandonment, he's completely neglected his responsibilities as a husband. He's not leading. He's not providing. He is abandoned emotionally, physically, then potentially. Now, again, that's a case-by-case basis. Has he abandoned you for a day? Has he abandoned you for a year? What does that look like? What are the details? Who's spoken into that? Is he repentant? Can he? So, but potentially. So that may be the abandonment piece. So, potentially. Okay? All right. Let's keep moving. Okay? Now, these are life on life things. Okay? 12 and following. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. You hit somebody. Okay? You get in a fist fight and you kill someone else. What happens to you? You think you're going to be a little bit less willing just to casually enter into some type of fist fight when you know my life's going to be on the line potentially? Absolutely. It's called taking responsibility for your body and what it does. Okay? But if he did not lie in wait for him, meaning this was not premeditated murder, it was potentially spur of the moment, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint a place for you which you may flee. This is manslaughter. This is second degree murder. Okay? It's still bad, but what happens? Does that person's life get taken from them if it wasn't premeditated? It was accidental.
He gets kicked out.
He gets kicked out, okay? And God says he's going to provide a place for him. Anybody know what that place is within Israel that you would go when you committed second-degree murder or manslaughter?
Sanctuary city.
Yeah, they're called cities of refuge. There's six of them that are listed in the book of Numbers, okay? It's house arrest. Three cities on each side of the Jordan, six total, that you went to if you committed a crime. You were not allowed to leave that city, the walls, ever. You were confined to that place. And the victim could not come in and exact revenge against you in that city. You were free to be there. Okay, we'll talk more about that concept as we get in the book of Numbers, but God sees the difference between first degree and second degree murder, if you will.
So the second case in verse 13 is if he stays alive, and it was an accident, or if the victim dies.
Yeah. No, I'm walking across a crosswalk. I'm not paying attention. You hit me with your car. It's completely accidental, but you kill me. Yeah. You're still guilty for negligent handling of your car.
Yeah.
But you get to go to a city instead of my family exacting revenge on you and taking your life.
What about,
you're welcome. I do that for you, Kyle.
What about self-defense type of purpose? Is that kind of like...
There's a point. Like, if you take someone's life in self-defense, then, you know what? Actually, there's a text that, let's get there. This is actually, we'll get there in just a second. We're almost there, okay? So that's the idea. Verse 15, he who strikes his father and mother shall be put to death. We saw this. Verse 16, he who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or is found in his possession, shall be put to death, okay? That's somebody else. That's a person. You treat them with respect. We kill you if you kidnap a person, even if you did them no harm, okay? 17, we read earlier. 18, okay? We got a bar fight. If men have a quarrel and one strikes another with a stone or with his fist and does not die, but he remains in bed, okay? You get in a fist fight with someone else and you send them to the ER, okay? Nobody dies, but you bust a guy up. Verse 19, if he gets up and walks around outside with his staff, then he who struck him shall go unpunished, okay? If this is just a minor scuffle, you leave it alone. He shall pay for his loss of time. He shall take care of him until he's completely healed. Okay? Thomas and I get in a fist fight in a bar. Okay? And I bust him up a little bit. Okay? Thomas probably busts me up a little bit. That would probably be a better picture. Okay? Let's call it what it is. And I end up going to the ER. Thomas is paying my ER deductible. He's paying for my time that I missed off of work. And he's caring for me financially until I get back on my feet again. You think that's expensive?
It's like the...
My $500 ER deductible and all the stuff that I'm going to miss at work, my salary that I'm going to miss for 2 weeks, my ice bag, you know, my Netflix bill that I need to watch when I'm at home, right? He's covering all that. You think you're going to handle your body a little bit differently when you know these are the consequences of my actions.
That's kind of like a rule of reconciliation. Like, you have to reconcile with that person.
Absolutely. And we're going to see it's not just reconciling, but you're going to pay that, and then you're going to add 20% on top of it.
Okay.
When you pay it back. Okay, we're going to see that. You guys remember Zacchaeus, the wee little man that Jesus met, the tax collector? We see him when he is righting wrongs with people as a tax collector. He adds one-fifth to everything he pays back, 20% interest. Okay, because that's what the Old Testament said. So as you read that text in the New Testament, the reason it says he adds a fifth is because we see it in the law. He's trying to walk with God in accordance with that. Okay, gang, amazingly so, these are the lessons that I'm trying to teach my children and the kids that I work with day in and day out. Personal responsibility. You are responsible for your body. Okay, it's going to go as far as you're responsible for your ox in your yard. Okay, we're going to see that in 21 as well. Amazing concept that people just did this and said, yeah, I am responsible for the decisions I make and what I do with my own body. And there are repercussions when I handle that incorrectly. Fascinating. Amazing how well this system worked. But it's old and antiquated and God's not real, so why should we do this anyway, right? Amazing how we handle this, okay?
What if, let's say we're in that quarrelsome moment and you are like completely provoked into hitting the other person, so like the dude's like legit, like knows what buttons to push and pushes all of them multiple times, and then that provokes you into like hitting him. And he's like, "Whoa, now you gotta take care of me."
You're still 110% responsible for your actions. You're responsible for how you handle your body. Walk away, right? So, and that's what God's trying to teach them. I don't care. I don't care what he said, right? Now. Anyway, so it's hard, but that's the issue. And obviously these would have been handled on a case-by-case basis by maybe judges of the land or what have you, but that's how it was done. Okay? How about this? Look at verse 22. Read that.
If people are fighting and hit a pregnant woman, she gives birth prematurely, but there is no serious injury, the offender must be fined whatever the woman's husband demands. And the court allows.
The idea is this woman has a premature birth, okay, a miscarriage, okay, but there's no further injury. This guy gets fined, okay. But verse 23, if there's any further injury, you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. If this woman loses her kid in the process, what happens to the guy? He gets killed, okay. How does God see the unborn? Weird. They're actually alive. They're actually people. They actually have values. They actually have rights. They're actually treated such. Okay, they're not a fetus. With no. Okay, so sorry. It's just that's what here. This is God's opinion, not mine. Yeah, Katie.
When Jesus talks about like when they say like eye for eye, tooth for tooth, and he says like we've all committed murder in our hearts, like where do you draw the line between like what this is saying and like following this and being like okay, well I've murdered in my heart, like where?
Yeah.
Do you...
I think the idea with that is he's trying to say. All you self-righteous people that think you've never committed murder, you've never committed adultery. Have you ever lusted after a woman? You've committed adultery. Have you ever wanted to take this guy's life and you're in your heart, you're angry? Then you've done this. You're all guilty. He's trying to get them to a guilty posture. It's not so much speaking on how we handle these things necessarily today. So, yeah. Yes, sir.
Where does that stand with people nowadays who get abortions? But not for, you know, pro-choice motives, more along the lines of the mother is going to die along with the child.
Yeah.
Where does that stand?
I don't think we can paint this on there in terms of the consequences of that. I don't think that's what we're talking about in this text. I think the idea here is God values life. And those are, again, case-by-case situations. Okay, so those are hard conversations. It is odd to me that is continually the argument that is made from the pro-choice side, that a woman's life could be in danger if she doesn't get an abortion. I was just reading an article the other day by a gynecologist who said, by the way, that never happens. That is never, ever the case where you have to terminate a fetus in order to save a mother. That never happens. Like 0% of the time is that medically necessary. But that's the argument that we hear as the exception. And all of us would go, oh, well, gosh, I don't want Hannah and her baby to die. So, gosh, I must really hate Hannah. I must concede that that's the case. Well, how often does that happen? Gynecologist who deals with this 24/7? Never. So for what it's worth, it's just interesting the arguments that are made. And clearly that's not the agenda of that side. The agenda is women's rights and other things that are driving that agenda, but they have to find something that's palatable to you and me who care about those type of values.
I'm just confused. It says if men contend with each other and a pregnant woman is hurt so that she has a miscarriage, like, does that mean if she's hurt in, like, the process of, like, what the...
If she's hurt and her baby's okay, you're okay. Still paying her fine.
Got it.
Nothing happens to the baby. Okay. But if she loses that child in the process, whole different ball of wax. Okay? But yeah, that's the idea. Okay? 28. Read that one. That's a good one.
If an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten. But the owner of the ox shall go unpunished.
All right, you got an ox that breaks its fence, right? And it's your property, and it gores somebody to death. What happens to your ox?
It's stoned.
Huh? Why? Because that is your property. You are responsible for that ox. You got a pit bull or some type of ravaged dog that doesn't like to control itself and bite cyclists? We get chased by dogs all the time. It's amazing. Are you responsible as a property owner for your stuff? Yes. Okay. However, keep reading, Derek. Or Katie, if Derek can't get there quick enough. 29.
If, however, the boy had the habit of goring and the owner has been warned.
So you got an ox that's in a habit of breaking its fence and goring people. It's done this now more than once. What happens?
When it has not kept it planned up and it kills a woman or man, the bull is to be stoned and its owner also is to be put to death.
Wow. You're a negligent owner, and this ox has now gored two people, and the owner has been warned, and it does it again. What happens? Ox dies and you die.
That's not the owner's fault, though.
You're dang right it's the owner's fault. You take responsibility for yourself and your stuff. And if you can't, then you don't have enough responsibility to handle that. Are you with me? This is the society, gang, that we don't live in. And that is the lie that we're told. We're not responsible. That's not my fault. Yes, it is your fault. You built the fence, or you should have built a better one. This isn't a one-time accidental thing, right? This is a habitual, neglectful, irresponsible individual. And their irresponsibility is causing harm and death to other people. You're dang right it's your fault, okay? Can you tell them a little bit of passion about this? Dang, seriously, this is an area. It seems so simple, but we don't do this as a society. We're victims. Stuff happens to us oftentimes. Now, there are certainly things that are legit that are not that way, but in issues like this, that's got to be the owner's response. Oh, I don't know, and it's not my fault. God's saying it is, and you've got to take responsibility for yourself and your stuff, okay? So, again, if we thought this way, things would just look different. Would we agree?
Yeah.
Right?
What I mean by, like, it's not his fault.
And I'm not hammering on you, Aaron, just to, sorry.
Wait, what?
I'm not giving you a bad time, so I'm just...
Oh, no, yeah. No, I mean, like that thing is massive strong. Like,
yep.
So if it gores one person, I mean, obviously the responsibility is like, okay, I got warned, I'm going to kill this thing and eat it or sell the meat or something and not have a boar ever again.
Yeah. And that would be your responsibility as an owner. Handle the situation appropriately. If you choose not to, then you're going to deal with the consequences thereof. Okay? So, tough. Okay? So that's the idea. 32. If the ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall give his or her master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. You're going to pay for that master to get another servant. And you're going to stone your ox. So, again...
this is that illustration you're talking about earlier where Joseph was sold for 20.
Yeah.
And the slave is worth 35 or 40.
Yes. How much was Jesus sold for?
30 pieces of silver.
30 pieces of silver. The price of a gored slave. Sold. Okay. Again, just tidbits of New Testament. You go, oh, that number actually means something. So, the value that... This is the value that... What's the guy's name? Disciple that sold Jesus?
Judas.
Thank you, Judas. I'm like, where is that thing? But value, okay? Tough. How about this? This is where we see it, right here in 22:1. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it and sells it, he shall pay five oxen for the ox and four sheep for the for the sheep. You're going to pay with interest. Okay, this is one of my favorite laws right here, verse 2. 22:2.
If a thief is caught breaking in at night and is struck a fatal blow, the defender is going to see bloodshed.
Okay, so if you have a thief that's breaking into your house and you deal that thief a fatal blow, there's no blood guiltness. Okay, it means no, you're not guilty. Okay, but if the sun has risen on him and there will be blood guiltness on his account, he shall surely make restitution. If he owns nothing, then he shall be sold for his debt. So if time has passed and you kill the guy not in the heat of the moment, then you're guilty. Okay, there's actually a Texas law in verse 2 that says if you have someone breaking into your home, if they die in the process of breaking in outside of your home, it's handled differently than if someone dies breaking into your home and they are inside of your home. So the idea is in Texas, you shoot someone and then you drag them into your house. This is where they lie. It's different.
Nice.
So, anyway. Tongue-in-cheek. Okay. But that's the idea. So God's saying, if it's in the heat of the moment and you heard an individual's breaking into your home, and they're responsible. So you're responsible for your actions and your body and the way you handle yourself. So. No, he was inside. So
don't do that.
Yeah, so don't.
The police might figure
it
out.
Yeah. not suggested.
My version says, if it's breaking in at night, it's not bloodshed, but if it happens after sunrise, so if they break in during the day.
They're saying there's a difference in between night and day. So if it's at night, it's handled differently than it is during the day.
But that's the break-in. Like if they break in the middle of the day and you kill them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly.
What if I invite him over for dinner?
Then he shoots.
He's a guest. What's my daughter?
Exactly. All right. How about this? Verse 5. If a man lets his field or his vineyard be grazed over or grazed bare and lets his animal loose so that it grazes in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best of his own field and the best of his property. If your ox eats all the food in your field and then breaks through the fence and eats all the food in Jordan's field, what do I have to do with my ox? Or what do I have to do for Jordan since my ox ate his stuff? I got to write him a check and say, man, I'm sorry. That's my fault. I was irresponsible taking care of this animal that I couldn't provide for, and there were greener pastures, literally. So he ate your food. Okay, that's the idea. Okay, so theft, that's actually considered in the Old Testament theft. Okay. Laws concerning, in verse 7, you see the title, at least in mine, dishonesty. So there's issues of, man, how you handle yourself and your stuff. That sort of thing. Okay? How about this one? In verse 13, we see an idea of a sheep or an animal that dies. Read 22:13.
If it was torn to pieces by a wild animal, the neighbor shall bring in the remains as evidence and shall not be required to pay for the torn animal.
This is fascinating. So if you have a sheep that gets out and dies, but it was not done intentionally, and it dies in my lawn, I can bring this dead sheep back and say, hey, your sheep died in my lawn. I don't have to pay you anything, even though it was technically under my care, it was in my property. Okay, it's a cool picture of the Jacob and Laban situation. Okay, Jacob was in charge of Laban's sheep. Laban's sheep died in his care. All he could have done was bring it back as evidence and say, hey, sorry, this got torn to shreds, but it got torn to shreds by a wild animal. It has nothing to do with me. I don't owe you a thing. What did Jacob do? He paid it back out of his own flock. Wasn't his responsibility? He took responsibility for it. That's the higher bar, which is pretty cool to see that idea. Okay. How about this? Verse 16. Let's talk about sex and marriage.
If a man seduces a virgin who is not pledged to be married and sleeps with her, he must pay the bride price, and she shall be his wife.
Hmm. You're a single dude. You hook up with a girl at a bar. You sleep with her. What is she now to you?
Wife.
Your wife. Because sex belongs in marriage. God says you're going to pay the dowry. Okay. If her father absolutely refuses to give him to her, why would a father refuse to give her to him? Because you're a scumbag. So I'm not going to allow my daughter to marry you. Which, again, in that society, would be so telling of that man that he must be a super big scumbag if a father would allow a woman who's been violated or has lost her virginity not to be married. That's a hard, a stereotype to kind of throw off in that society. He shall pay money equal to the dowry rights of virgins. So basically the dad's going to get to say, you're going to write a check for whatever amount I choose, And I'm going to keep my daughter. Thank you very much. So again, this the context of how valued that is. Again, responsibility for your body. Are you going to think differently about sleeping with a woman who's not your wife when you know I have to take responsibility for her? I am claiming her as my own to protect her, to provide for her. And that's what this action means. Oh, you mean it's not just 5 minutes of pleasure at the end of my night and I get to cast her off and say, see you later? No, not in Israel. Take care of your body. Take care of your stuff. Take responsibility for your actions. So this is God's heart in all this. Okay. Verse 18, you shall not allow the sorceress to live. We're not going to have any false worship in Israel, the occult, witchcraft. We're going to see that later on underneath Saul, that's actually going on. Verse 19, laws you would think need to be here, need to be here. Whoever lies with an animal shall surely be put to death. I know a pastor who had to deal with this in his ministry. Okay, and the guy's talking to him about it, and he thought he was joking the whole time, and went, you're not joking. And this guy was struggling with this. So
did he put him to death?
He did not put him to death, thankfully. He gave him good counsel and got the guy out of that situation, but this happens, okay? He who sacrifices to anyone other than the God, the Lord alone, shall be utterly destroyed. Here's some cool laws, okay? 21, how about this?
Do not mistreat or oppress a foreigner. Well, you were foreigners in Egypt.
You have someone who comes into your land that has a different skin color, that speaks a different language, that worships other gods. How do you treat them? With respect and with love. Why? What is God reminding them of? Because, man, you did not get treated that way for 440 years in Egypt. So when you have a stranger that needs help, though they don't speak like you, look like you, act like you, believe what you believe, how do you treat them? You treat them with the respect that they deserve because they are humans. They are the imago Dei. They are made in the image of God, and you treat them as such. Okay? So, God is not a fan of racism. He is not a fan of classism. He's not a fan of weatherism that we can throw in here that's not biblical. He says, you're not going to do that. You're not going to treat people that way. You're not going to afflict a widow or an orphan. You will take care of people that have a harder time taking care of themselves. You get a single mom or a widow who's had now a husband die, you take care of her in the society. This is the way to take care of them. Okay, you have an orphan who's lost their parents, you take care of them as well. Okay, if you afflict him at all, speaking of the orphan in verse 23, and if he cries out to me, I will surely hear his cry, my anger will be kindled, and I will kill you with the sword, and the wives shall become widows and your children fatherless. And man, you think God takes that seriously? I will personally take responsibility for that orphan that you're neglecting. And those are strong words, okay? Verse 25, if you lend money to my people, okay, I go broke and you got to loan me money. You don't charge me interest, according to verse 25, okay? If all I have is my cloak and I have to give you my jacket for the day, saying, hey, I promise to work for you, here's my deal, you have to give it back to me at the end of the night, verse 27, to make sure that I have something to sleep in and can be warm. You don't get to keep it overnight. And keep that, okay? How about this, verse 28? Anybody guilty of this? Read that.
Do not blaspheme God or curse the ruler of your people.
Right? I remember teaching in a sermon right after Obama got reelected, and we were teaching Romans 13. It talks about the idea of God being sovereign over government. Did you vote for Obama? It doesn't matter. You have to treat him with respect and dignity and speak well of him. He is the ruler of our people. Whether I voted for him or not, it does not matter. I respect him and I respect the office that he holds, knowing that that is appointed by God. And his election was not by accident. That was seen by God, okay? Not necessarily his will, but man, in the day and age right now, when we are in fearful times with our president-elect right now, we need to speak well of him, okay? Whether you voted for him or not, whether you like him or not, whether you think he's a turd or not, we need to hope for the best and pray like crazy that he surrounds himself with good people.
Is there a difference between speaking well about the person or just speaking facts?
You don't slander an individual.
Yeah.
he's dug his own grave, so he can deal with his actions and his words. And gang, to be honest with you, I was sitting with one of our grant relationships that we have it off the front that deals with the forgotten, deals with immigrants, that deals with this group of people specifically that are absolutely terrified of the current political condition in our nation and what's coming. And it's scary. And I appreciated the way that this gal that I was working with handled it. She's very clearly not in favor of this guy being the president, but did not slander him and said, man, we need to protect these people. And the best we can, need to make sure that we speak for those that don't have a voice, especially as the church. Okay, so it's a hard time. We need to be sensitive to that. And there's a lot of people that are being idiots. So unfortunately, some of the folks that voted for Trump and are speaking loudly in a racist and unfair way, we need to put an end to that. We need not be guilty of that. Okay, so don't like him all you want, but don't slander him, and let's stand up for the people that potentially have the ability to be oppressed by him.
I mean, that's similar to what David did with Saul, right? Like he knew Saul was not the greatest guy.
Absolutely.
God appointed him even still.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. David never misspeaks to Saul, and you're going to see the lengths that he goes to not to do that at all. It's fascinating. Okay. So, for what it's worth, okay? 23:1, do not bear false report, okay? Be honest. Verse 4, if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you shall surely return it to him. Man, that guy's my neighbor, and I can't stand him. I hate his guts. And I'm walking to work one day, and I see my neighbor's ox out wandering away. What is my job? Get the ox, take it back to my neighbor. Hey, buddy, your ox got out. Even if I don't like him? Yep. Is that hard? Yep. But that's the culture that God is setting for the people. Do you see, by the way, how this would work pretty well? Personal relationships, personal responsibility, care for people that you don't like, whether you don't like them or not, treat them with respect and dignity because they're made in the image of God. Yeah, that's how this is supposed to work. Yeah, dude.
So that neighbor I was telling you about earlier,
mm-hmm.
One day I got out of my car, and her debit card was like on the floor next to her car, and I took it to it. And I like knocked on the door and said, hey, you left
it. Did you remind
her of
that?
It's my favorite person right there in the whole world for the morning.
Oh, Katie's had her coffee this morning. She's on fire now. All right.
You want some water?
Well, that's a train whistle, huh? Yeah, Jim.
Oh my goodness.
I also think it's interesting that people are doing studies nowadays and saying that, you know, the more you care for someone you don't like, the more you tend to like them. You know? And I think that's so funny that they're just now coming up with these studies and it's not here. You know?
It's here. There you go. Okay. Verse 10 and following, we're talking about the Sabbath days and the different seasons. This is kind of cool. Three times a year, verse 15, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Verse 16, the Feast of the Harvest or Pentecost and the ingathering. And then the Feast of, Passover, Harvest, and then the ingathering, Shavuot. All males, verse 17, had to come back before the Lord, which meant when the tabernacle turned into the temple that we'll talk about maybe next week at this point, you had to road trip, you and your family, guaranteed the male, but you had to come back and celebrate a feast of the Lord. Okay, three times a year you had to come back to Jerusalem to worship. And it was this time where you said, listen, we're stopping, we're not working, this isn't a vacation, but we're going to come together in community and worship God. Mandatory three times a year. Kind of cool. So, demanded worship and that sort of thing. Okay? Let's see. Look at verse 24 about worshiping different gods. 23:24.
Do not bow down before their gods or worship them or follow their practices. You must demolish them and break their sacred stones to pieces.
God's saying, hey, one day I'm going to bring you back into the land that I promised you, the land of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. When you get there, there is going to be false gods in the land. You don't worship them. I am the God, God alone. We're going to hear that verse repeated over and over and over. And the reason that Israel screws up so royally and ultimately gets kicked out of the land a second time is because primarily of this issue. They worship false gods, and they will not remove them from their midst. Okay, we laugh at that, but we have our own false gods that we serve. They don't look like G.I. Joe action figure idols, but they look like
functional savers.
Exactly, right? Absolutely. Okay? So that's the idea. So God has given this idea to them. So a lot of these laws, as you guys read through, especially this first piece, you're seeing just a smattering of very practical, very honest living in how the Israel's to do that. Okay. Now, chapter 25, I want you to stick your finger there. And then turn to your right and just keep grabbing pages till you get all the way over to chapter 31. Really 32. Okay, all of that section are blueprints as to how you're going to build a building. Okay, do you think this matters to God? That is a lot of pages. Okay, 32 and 33 and 34 are like a parenthesis. Okay, 35 all the way to the end of the book of Exodus to chapter 40 is the building of the blueprint that God just gave you. A third of the book of Exodus is about Moses, you're on the mountain. Here are the blueprints of the house of worship that I want you to build. And now go down the hill and build it. A third of the book is about that. Wow. Fascinating to me. And it's honestly, yeah, we look at it and it's lampstand this and table that and this needs to be this color. And it's just, it's detailed, I dotting, crossing the T to a degree that we're like, holy cow, right? You probably haven't heard a lot of preaching done in chapter 25 and following in Exodus, because it's like reading somebody's laundry list, or it's a punch list in a house. It's insane, but it's important. So,
are you going to show us the picture of what it looks like?
Yep, we'll do that right now. So we'll get through what we can. Chapter 25 will begin the construction of what is called the tabernacle. So I'll wake back up for you.
Ricky.
All right. Alex, thanks again, man. You and me. Looking for Apple TV.
No problem. There we go.
Is this a fourth or a third?
TV card?
Third.
I didn't see it.
But.
You're kidding.
Why are you not working?
Hey, Mr. Slayton.
Sir.
Was the temper that they talk about in Exodus anything similar to the temper that Solomon built in the first
place? I'm going to tell you all about that right now. As soon as Alex can fix his computer to make it work better. Okay? Do you mind? Next year. See if you can, for whatever reason, something to connect. So let's talk about this for a second. Or we can watch a movie. You guys want to watch a movie?
Yeah.
Oh, has anybody seen this?
That movie.
No.
Oh, I haven't.
Turn
seen
Wi-Fi off. Turn it back on.
It's not all that great.
We're obviously connected.
No movies. You guys still watch? I need to separate them. Go watch that war movie. What is it? I forget. It's that dude that was a Christian that never picked up a Jew. It's so good.
So let's start in just chapter 25 as Alex is picking this up, okay? Sorry. So as God reveals these blueprints, here's how it starts. God speaks to Moses 25:1 and says, "Tell the sons of Israel to raise a contribution for me." So here's how we're going to build the structure. All of it is going to come from the people and their financial, and not even really financial as much as it is like there's stuff to build these things. So you're going to provide the curtains, the thread, the whatever, okay? This is the contribution, verse 3, which you're going to make. Gold, silver, bronze, all these fabrics in verse 4 that we read about. Verse 8, let them construct a sanctuary for me that I may dwell among them, okay? Sanctuary, tabernacle, what's the other word that's used? Anyway, the idea is this is where God is going to dwell. So this is going to be his living quarters. And we're going to see Of all the places that God chooses to dwell, the epicenter, the middle of his people, as they camp in the wilderness, is where he's going to set up shop. Okay? So he's not in heaven where he can't be reached. He's not outside of the people. He's not untouchable. He's in the very center of their camp. And this structure that he's going to have him make is going to be literally where his physical presence can be seen daily. Okay? Still fighting his pants? It's bizarre. All right. It's funny how things worked earlier. Murphy's Law is wonderful. Okay? So I will show you guys a couple photos of that if we can get it rolling. Verse 10 and following, we're going to watch now each individual piece of the tabernacle get formed. Okay? And I'll show you the size and the dimensions here in a moment. Okay? The first person we see, first piece that we see, is the ark and the mercy seat. So the ark of God that we've all seen in Indiana Jones, right? This is what we're talking about. So they kind of start with the highlighted area. Verse 10, they shall construct an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits long. Okay, a cubit is 18 inches, so we'll kind of get all those measurements later. You're going to overlay it, verse 11, with pure gold. So this ark that's going to house, what's in the ark? You guys remember, by the way, later on, what ends up inside the ark?
The tablets,
the broken law of Moses. The manna, a jar of manna from their 40 years to remind them how God provided for them. One more thing.
Scroll.
Not the scrolls.
Staff.
It's the budded staff in Numbers 17 of Aaron to remind them how God provided this kind of really cool miracle. Okay, so that's the idea. So those are going to house inside the ark itself.
Do we know what happened to the ark?
We don't. There's some conjectures as to what took place. We lost it during the Babylonian captivity when the Babylonians came in. So around 586 BC, that's when it disappeared.
But
so
we had it up through that point?
Yeah, we had it up through that point. And we'll see the ark's journey all through all through those times. We'll be able to track it up till then. And after that, it's a complete mystery. Okay, so this thing, it's going to be overlaid in gold. Super impressive. You'll notice in verse 12 how they're to carry it. You're going to put gold rings on it to fasten them on each side. So literally they would put like these big eyelets on the side of the ark. You would put a pole through those eyelets. You couldn't even touch the ark itself. And then there was a certain group of people that would take those poles, put them on their shoulder, kind of like the procession of a coffin. And you would carry it that way. But you couldn't even touch the ark itself. Okay? So God, it was instructed in how it was to move. There was a certain group of people that could touch the elements and to move the ark, but it was a very limited group of folks. Okay, the ark, by the way, is a really cool picture. So you've got this golden box. It's built out of wood, overlaid with gold. Verse 16, you're going to put the ark of testimony in it, which I'm going to give you. So the laws that I'm about to give you, the Ten Commandments, are going to go in there. All that's going to be overlaid with gold. Verse 21, another piece to the ark. Okay, 21, read that.
Place the cover on top of the ark and put in the ark the tablets of the covenant law that I will give you.
Okay, 21, the mercy seat, the cover, okay? The atonement cover on top of the ark, okay? 22.
There, above the cover, the two cherubim that are over the top of the covenant law, I will meet with you and give you all my commands for the Israelites. All
right, so I will meet with you above the cover of the ark. This is a fascinating picture, okay? As we talk about the Day of Atonement coming in Israel later, I want you to see this, okay? So you've got the ark of God. On top of that is the mercy seat, okay? Okay, there's the ark, okay? This is what it would have looked like. So golden box. You've got two angels represented with their wings covering it, okay? On top of that, again, is pure gold. One day a year, the priest would come in and put the shed blood of an animal on top of the mercy seat, the atonement cover, in between the broken law of God, the broken law of the people that's inside the ark, and a holy God is the blood spilled for another that covers the broken law, right? It's a picture of how this kind of whole process works, okay? So all these elements are super important, okay? So let me just walk you guys through kind of a timeline and the pieces that we're going to see. So,
must have been heavy.
Yeah, very much so, okay? So again, Exodus is 1446 BC. It's when they leave Egypt. Okay, that's the conservative dating of the Exodus. A year later, we're going to construct the tabernacle, okay? This thing is going to be the operating system of the Israelites for the 40 years that they're wandering around the wilderness, as well as the time when they get into the land. Okay? Then there's a guy by the name of David who says, man, we should build a permanent house for God. Now that we've been here, we've got a kingdom. About 1000 BC, when David starts to reign, he says, I want to build God a house. Not this Coleman pop-up tent that's kind of raggedy and not impressive. We're all dwelling in these like cedar-lined, sweet houses, and God has this little shanty tent. We should build him something nice. David gets the okay, and then kind of doesn't get the okay. The whole theology of the temple is fascinating as to whether or not God wanted that or not, which is interesting because you get the third of the book of Exodus saying, this is the house I want built for me. I want a portable tent, not a house. Okay, we'll talk about that more later. But God says to David, you don't get to build this, but I will allow your son Solomon to build it. And Solomon builds the very first temple. Okay, and all the elements that we're going to see in the tabernacle get entered into the temple. So now we have a permanent house. Okay, 586 BC, Babylon comes in, destroys Israel, Judah southern, the proper location, where the temple was in Jerusalem. That gets destroyed. And then when they come back into the land 70 years later, Zerubbabel, Nehemiah, and Ezra, they come back in and build what's called the Second Temple. Okay, Solomon's temple was insane, to the nines, everything to the nines. Okay, the Second Temple, people are broke. So, man, they were using really nice stuff, and now it's like, man, we don't have much. And it says the old generation that saw the old temple wept on the grand opening of the new temple, the Second Temple, because of how unimpressive it was. And you have a generation that during a party when they're supposed to be celebrating the Second Temple being built are weeping. Okay? So, that temple gets used all the way up through Herod, the Herod that wanted to kill all the little babies during Jesus' day, that Herod, Herod the Great, Herod the megalomaniac nutjob. When you go to Israel, we study a lot about Herod. He's an interesting dude. I won't give you a ton of background with him, but he basically wanted to please the Romans and please the Jews. Okay? Herod was put in place in power over Jerusalem by the Romans, but the Jews didn't like him. So he says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make you a sweet temple mount. So I'm going to take the temple that you guys have built, and I'm going to expand it. And this build project was ridiculous. He makes it way, way bigger, and it literally takes him from 20 BC all the way to 67 AD. Okay? 87-year build project. Okay, and he finishes, and it gets destroyed 3 years later. Okay? So that's the idea. Okay? So the service of the temple was there for 585 years. Herod expands it, and then the Romans come in and wreck shop, and literally it says there's not a stone that was left unturned. They wrecked everything. Okay? Now, today, modern day wise, if you go to Israel and you see the Temple Mount, there is no anything Jewish up there. It's all Muslim, okay? In 685 BC, the Dome of the Rock, which was is a Muslim monument, is on top of the Temple Mount, as well as a place called the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Al-Aqsa means farthest place, and we'll study that more later. But they have current control of the Temple Mount itself in Jerusalem, and their shrines are up there. Okay, their house of worship, which is a mosque, as well as kind of the Dome of the Rock, which is that big other thing that is up there. Okay, I'll show you those real quick just before we get too much further, just so you guys can have an idea of modern day what that looks like.
We call it the Temple Mount. What do they call it? It's not a temple to them, right?
I don't know. That's a great question. I'm not sure. Okay, so this is the Al-Aqsa Mosque right here. Okay, this is the place where they worship on top of the Temple Mount. Jews aren't allowed to go in there, only Muslims. They recently let a camera crew in there for the first time in like years. You can Google some of the pictures. It's beautiful, very ornate, but very Muslim. Yeah, Jimmy.
So the Muslims built a mosque on the one place that the Jews could put a temple.
Correct. I'll walk you through all that here in a bit, okay? Next week, okay? And then this is the Dome of the Rock. The big golden structure is their place of worship as well. So those are their two kind of shrines to Muslim. I'll walk you guys through the history of that and why that's the case. There's a lot of battles and wars that got fought as to why that is the way it is. What's fascinating is the Jews actually took control. Did I have that on there?
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. So there was a war in 1967 where the Jews actually took control of the Temple Mount. Okay, and their prime minister at the time, I forget his name, had control of the Temple Mount and had the freedom to do whatever he wanted to with it. He gave it back to the Muslims. We look at that and go, what the heck? Why? It was such a contested place that he knew if they hung on to it, literally, it's like the beginning of World War III. So it was an act of saying, you know what? What's best for my people is actually to keep them safe. We're going to return the Temple Mount to them in order to be a peaceful nation. He handed it back over to the Muslims. So today, Israel, Jerusalem, all in Israel's control, but they allow the Muslims to worship up there. And that's their place. And they have to ask permission to go. And certain times when we're in Israel, we can't go up there because it's a Muslim holy day. Or for whatever reason, they won't allow us up. But they do not like Jews up there, foreigners up there. And oftentimes you'll see in the news great deals of tension when you're seeing Americans or what have you. So I've been up there a few times. It's a pretty cool experience. But they won't let you teach anything about Christianity, anything about Judaism. It all has to be a Muslim focus in that story. So there's a lot of tension that's surrounding this. This is the most hotly debated piece of land in the entire world. And there's more tension in this piece of land because everyone thinks it's theirs. The Muslim think it's theirs for their line of theology, which I'll walk you through. The Jews obviously think it's theirs because the Bible says that it is. And then the Americans think that it's theirs, not the Americans, the Christians think it's theirs because Jesus died somewhere in this area, and we're the New Jerusalem, and we are the Jews, we're the people of God, so all of this is ours. Okay, so it's a really weird deal. Okay, so you get some funky theology that comes out of all this. So again, but I just want you to see the big picture system. So the tabernacle is ultimately going to turn into the temple, and we'll walk kind of through that next week. So we don't have enough time to cover it all today. So why don't we pause here, but you guys can get an overview. This, by the way, is in Dropbox if you guys want to take a look at any of these photos. Next week when I come in, I'll actually bring my computer and show you guys a little bit more. Sorry, not next week.
Unless you're probably home here for Thanksgiving.
No, I'm not. Sorry, thank you. Enjoy your Thanksgiving. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks. So you're off.